It might be a nice room somewhere.
Call the House Healthcare Committee to order. Open up a work session on 2009. Representative Kenner around?
Doing the hard work first.
Yes, he's right in the hallway.
Please. You've all received whoever got the BlackBerry or the cell phone, would you all please follow my lead? Take the cell phone out of your pocket. Let's see. Hold it up like this when you take it out of your pocket. Anybody that doesn't have a cell phone, everybody with a cell phone out there? All right, everybody leave then. Come on back in.
Can't prove it's off.
Let's get the cell phones out. Shut them off.
Oh, boss.
Okay, you all received the sort of, I was going to say, the hand-engrossed version of 209. It was hand in that it was fingers to the keyboard. And with instructions that the red things are the adds and the deletes. My intention now is to take up a bunch of amendments. And the amendments that I want to do today, first of all, I want to remove the dash 44s because they're going to be replaced by something else. And then I want to add the 57s, 59, 60, 61, 62, 64, 65, 66, and 69. And when we add those, I then will want to debate the bill itself and move the bill out. I'm going to do that first. We'll get the other things after that. And the only bills we can move if we want to are 3103, 2535, and 2925. Is that right? Those are the only ones we can move today. Is that the only one we have fiscals on?
25, 35, 31, 03, and 29, 25.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
There was discussion about another amendment coming on Bill 2009 on Wednesday. Do we? And I believe you just said that you were talking about moving
without
2009
the last amendment. Yeah, in fact, there are two that we're not going to have on that will pass out of the Senate. We can't get the amendments in time.
But we will pass. We will try to
we'll
move this bill today.
Yep.
Thank you, sir.
Yep.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move the dash 40 amendments to House Bill 2009.
No.
I haven't opened the... Did I open the work session?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
So I'm moving the dash 40 amendments to House Bill 2009, dated April 10th, 2009.
And do we have the dash 40s in front of us?
They were distributed about a week and a half ago. It is the referral to the voters.
I thought we voted on that once.
You did not vote on this. You voted on it for 2116. So this is a different bill.
Okay. All right. Any discussion?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I raised some of our concerns the other day, I think Representative Maurer has, you know, I understand your desire to put it out there, but I really think it's our job to pass these things. It's not about passing it on to the voters. This is a policy change that we are told this is our job, and that's what we're doing as elected representatives. I would not be in favor of sending it out to the voters.
Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
No.
Representative Dembrough?
No.
Representative Garrett?
No.
Vice Chair Harper?
No.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
No.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
No. Motion fails.
That's the last one.
We need a motion to suspend the rules.
I have one. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the -44 amendment to HB 2009.
Is there any objection? Okay, the motion carries, and now we reconsider the vote.
Well, you might take a roll call if suspension of the rules requires seven. Did you have?
There was no,
okay. No opposition, so we have okay. 10. Now we need to move -44 again.
Right. Mr. Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed the -44 amendments to House Bill 2009.
We have a motion before us to reconsider the... We have a vote on... Okay. Now we... Okay. Harker moves to reconsider the vote by which -44 amendments were passed. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just what we're I'm digging here, but I haven't found them. What
the 44 is?
Yeah.
44 is being replaced by the 60 by the -69s.
Essentially the same?
Yeah, it's the same purpose, but
thank
better
you,
language.
I
so we want to take it out, and then we'll put 69 in.
Great.
It's about creating a small business option, which is what Representative Maurer has urged okay. an ODS amendment, and we will move that in. Hearing no objection, motion carries, and -44 amendments are rescinded. I started to say where I was telling you where we were going is the only ones we have the ability to move on today besides 09 is 3103, 2535 and 2925. So those are the only ones we're going to work, unless there are some amendments to the other bills that are on the docket today. Are there proposed amendments? Can I go through these one at a time? Are there proposed amendments on 2702?
There is a -2 amendment
okay.
on 2702.
That's and a cleanup on the -1, is that right?
And there's a -...
We
ended up with a -3 amendment.
No, okay, well, let's deal with the -2s. Can I have a motion
just
from you?
Excuse me. Look.
You want to make sure you look at them?
Yeah, I do.
Please. You pass those to Representative Kinnaman.
You also.
We're still open at 9, right?
Yes,
yeah,
I closed the work session 2009.
Sorry, I just. No.
There's three.
Is there anything on. No, there are no amendments on 2967, but we don't have... Are there? No, I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, may I ask what we're doing here?
I'm trying to find out what work we have that we can do today.
But excuse me, we've already passed the -3 amendments on that bill.
So they're already in there.
Right.
So the bill's already in there.
This
okay.
I think this is correct. Let me just check.
This is one where 3 replaced 1 and 4 replaced 2.
Okay.
And you voted on the -3 amendments.
And so, Mr. Chair, are you trying to announce for the...
I'm trying to announce which I'm carrying over.
Okay. And would you like to start... Could you start from the top, please?
I'm going to carry over... I will carry over HB 2702. Turns out there's something we need to work on today. We will. I'm going to carry over 2967. All of these to Wednesday. I'm going to carry over 3418. I hear there are some amendments coming for that. Powers, we have the material on the independent boards to open up a hearing after. Are you prepared for that? Okay. I'm going to carry over 2118, and that takes care of the carryovers.
And 2067, we can't move that out today.
All right.
We don't have a fiscal, so you're still going to need
you.
To carry over.
Okay. No, I don't. Which digital number? I can hear it.
Hmm? Okay.
Yeah, did you want to?
But if you want to work it, you're going to have to carry it over.
Thank you. I got it. All right. You have more than that. just moving a work session in 2009. I'm sorry?
I just had a question. On 2702, we did put in the dash 3 amendment, so I think we're up to speed. And then,
and we're waiting for the fiscal.
And we do not have the fiscal.
We do not have the fiscal.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We'll hear it. When will we hear it?
Well, that's good. It's the minute we get the fiscal.
Thank you.
But we're having a little trouble getting fiscal, so we're going to try and clear that up tomorrow in some discussions. It's a, generally speaking, in the terms of art of the legislature, things seem all screwed up. But we're going to work on that. Okay. We open a work session on House Bill 2009A, and I'll hear a motion on the dash 57 amendments, please, which I think you all have in front of you. These are the next five are all Senate bills that we're moving into the
57s.
There was the dash 57s. Yeah, you had them on Friday. These were all given out on Friday. That's Senate Bill 456, the patient-centered primary care integrated health home. So when I proposed we deal with by naming Sally, if we couldn't figure out what the right name was.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, okay.
Board of motion?
Please.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 57 amendments to House Bill 2009A, dated 4-17-09.
Is there any discussion on the dash 57 amendments? Referred to here, I think, is the patient-centered primary care home or something. Is there any objection?
PH.
The dash 57s are moved into 2009. Can I have a motion on the 59s, please?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 59 to House Bill 2009, dated April 17, 2009.
Is there any discussion on the dash 59s? Hearing no any objection? Hearing no objection, the dash 59s are moved into 2009. Motion on the dash 60s? Is that Dembro? Oh. No? Okay, whoever.
Mr. Chair, I move Amendment 60 to House Bill 2009A, dated 4-17-09.
Is there any objection to the... Any discussion on the dash 60s? Any objection to the dash 60s? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 61 amendments to House Bill 2009, also dated April 17.
That's Senate Bill 455, Healthcare Guidelines. Any discussion on...
Mr. Chair, I do object to this amendment. I think the baggage around the words comparative effectiveness research are substantial, and I have not been involved in any conversations about comparative effectiveness in the context of Oregon politics.
Yeah, I suspect the main... baggage that goes around that words is a $1.3 billion of federal money just been dedicated to comparative effectiveness research. I suspect that's where this came from.
Comparative effectiveness ultimately is a tool for rationing health care, and I think the primary the place that this has been used primarily is in Great Britain. It's the National Institute of Comparative Effectiveness, and has been in the news for denying care multiple times for very reasonable treatments. And I'm not quite sure Oregon wants to go there. But I am quite aware that the federal government is moving in this direction. But we'll put on the record today that this is rationing at its best.
Is it, can I ask, is looking at Section 1165, is it the 4 and 5 subsections of that on page 2 of the amendment that's causing you the trouble? Or is this the whole concept?
Sir, it's the whole concept. And I don't know how it's going to be utilized in Oregon. But if it's about putting a price tag on a human life and then suggesting that any treatment that costs more than the supposed retail value of a human life is money not well spent, is something that I'm not ready to decide.
Other comments? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I always appreciate Representative Maurer's comments. And I was wondering if we could have Dr. Smith or someone else from the Office of Policy and Health Research address this, only because I know this has been vetted on the Senate side. So I'm wondering if they could just elaborate on the use of that phrase.
I think that'd be great.
Thank you.
Please
thank
help
you,
us,
Mr.
Dr.
Chair.
Smith.
Just because every senator may have voted for it doesn't mean that it's...
I don't know they did.
I just want to make sure we're understanding. I think when you use the R word, I think that's a pretty loaded... I want to make sure that we're being careful when we say rationing on the record. I want to hear what that actually means. And
okay.
And maybe that is what it is, but I'd like to...
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, for the record, Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, which staffs the Health Resources Commission and the Health Services Commission. The term of comparative effectiveness has been on the national scene for medical technology assessments over the last several years from the several national meetings I've been going to. So it's a little more of a newer term for what we in Oregon have been doing since the early days of the health plan in looking at the best evidence and coming up with what's the best clinical guidelines. We've been doing this in the Medicaid program with our drug assessment program, where we've been looking at what's, you know, exhaustive review of the literature by the Oregon Health Sciences Center for Evidence. The Health Resources Commission then digests that down to make decisions about what would be the best recommendation based on that evidence to the Medicaid program. They do not get into the cost in that particular process. The Health Services Commission have been doing this extensively since the beginning of the prioritized list, clinical guidelines for particular procedures, primarily affecting the fee-for-service side of the Medicaid program, where the managed care plans do their own process. What this bill in the Senate side, 455, does is set up an opportunity for the Health Resources Commission, the Health Services Commission, to sit down with the insurers who are doing this on their own to decide what's medically necessary, make sure we're all using the same good quality of evidence to make decisions about what the plans would could we come to a common set of voluntary guidelines. Minnesota has been doing this for about 15, 20 years since I was actually in full-time family practice. It was a resource for looking at potential guidelines around diabetes, whether if I was an obstetrician, what do I have to do before I am allowed to do a vaginal hysterectomy? Did I check and make sure this and that had been done? So they have 54 medical groups, and their 6 top insurers have been doing this voluntarily in Minnesota to make decisions about how they would, all collectively sort of have the same guidelines. So me, doctor in an office, isn't looking at, well, this is the way Regents does it, this is the way Care Oregon does it, this is the way, can we have some common agreed upon clinical guidelines? Always understanding that there are individual patient situations and where we would make more individual decisions, but at least if the first drug we would use or the first procedure or approach we would use would be using the best available evidence and standards.
Thank you.
My concern is when you have one entity making that decision, that sort of takes the discussion, and you've now focused on one place. And Regents puts a lot of money. I mean, they have a vested interest in not wasting money. And HealthNet and Pacific, LifeWise, and all these insurance entities, Kaiser has a vested interest that they're not wasting money. And so to suggest that centralizing, communication is one thing, but to centralize the decision-making process, which, I'm sorry, I know it doesn't, but this is the onward march down the road that we're going to have one entity, and unfortunately it probably won't even be in Oregon, it'll be in Washington, D.C., and it's just not something that I'm comfortable with.
Chair Greenlee and Representative Maurer, the bill itself does not say there's one entity. It would be a collaborative volunteer collection of all the plans trying to be on the same page, and that it would be then... They would each decide if they're going to continue to interpret it, but if you think about it, you'd want us to be probably paying for the best evidence rather than, as we know in the past, we've paid for certain procedures to cure things such as bone marrow transplants for cancer, and we spent quite a bit of money on that for breast cancer, and turned out the evidence was bad, and it really didn't help as many people as possible, but everyone was paying for it, and for years before the evidence came out. So these are the kind of things where people make decisions by individual. We don't know all the reasons why different plans make different decisions. Regents does invest quite a bit into their research. I'm not sure everybody else is, you know, is it the best, are they using the best studies? Was that study at all slanted by who paid for that study? So, I mean, right now the HRC, no one can sit on, the, you know, they have to, like, disclose whether they're a participant in getting any gains from any decisions they might make. So do they have investments in pharmacy companies before they get on there? So that sort of thing. So it's trying to do it in an open...
Yeah, I want to add just one comment. I mean, I spent a lot of my life doing comparative effectiveness research, and we spend a lot of time in healthcare, in the clinical side of healthcare, making clinical decisions without information on whether A works better than B. It seems to me there should be nothing dangerous in research that determines whether A works more effectively than B. And there has been movements in the past that push too far the notion of qualities and other kinds of things that value life. But the fact is, the simple question is, when you have treatment A and treatment B, and if you don't have data that says which is most effective, then the argument is use the cheapest. If you have data that talks about cost effectiveness, the answer is sometimes the more expensive one is more cost effective. And that's essentially what I think this research is sort of looking at. It seems to me the research itself isn't dangerous. I mean, knowledge shouldn't be dangerous. Misuse of knowledge is where the danger comes in.
And I would agree.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Take a roll call, please, on the dash 61s.
Representative Dembro. Aye. Representative Garrett. Aye. Vice Chair Harker. Aye. Representative Kennemer. Aye. Representative Kotek. Aye. Vice Chair Maurer. No. Representative Thompson. Aye. Representative Bruin. Aye. Chair Greenlee. Aye. Motion carries 6-1. Is in it. Incidentally, for those of you in the room,
I already announced that 2702 did not have the fiscal. 2702 does have a fiscal now, and we'll take it up as soon as we're done with this. Let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's the psychologist prescribed. Let's have a motion on dash 62. How about you?
I can do that one.
I know. You like that
one. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 62 amendments to House Bill 2009 to April 17th, 2009.
For reference, that's the Pulse. We heard that. There's not only the opportunity to save money on this one, but the more important piece about this one is that it helps to ensure that people's last wishes actually get to be honored. And that's pretty important.
Next to last wishes. The
last wish dials 911.
Is that the
yeah, that's a different one. Okay, is there any discussion on Pulse? Any further discussion? Any objection? Pulse and dash 62 is in House Bill 2009A.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 63 amendments to House Bill 2009, just to keep it in order.
Dash 63.
Yeah, that's not on this.
That was handed out Friday.
got last time.
Okay. Which is the -63s?
-63 is a tax.
It is good to be. To have
tax deduction for health insurance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're in a row. Mr. Chair, -63 are a tax deduction for health insurance premiums. That's how the amendment is titled. Basically, this is a recognition that our health care market is anything but a health care market. It's like suggesting that if you walk into a restaurant, but you don't see the prices and somebody else always pays the bills, that that's somehow a real market. And we've had the third-party payer system with health care since World War II, and this would give the same tax advantages to individuals that corporations receive for purchase of health insurance. And I personally think this would go farther than anything else we could possibly do to get to universal coverage.
I'd be happy to comment on this. I think we really need to look seriously at this, but I think doing it in the middle of this bill in this particular time is going to be a big problem. I think the national bills that will have this will have this kind of stuff in it, but I think I have a problem putting it in here, and I think it's an important issue for us to be paying attention to.
Mr. Chair, the national bills may address your federal income tax, but we are disconnected from the federal income tax, and so we have to deal with our state tax code in a separate manner, and this bill does that. In fact, this is it was my bill, Representative Bruin. I mean,
this raises revenue, right?
Does it raise revenue? Well, I thought we were asking people to purchase insurance.
Who paid in cash?
Who paid
themselves?
Right. The 200,000 or so Oregonians. That is it 200,000 to, I'm looking, I don't know what the number is, but the number of Oregonians that buy individual insurance in the state of Oregon currently get no tax benefit. If you're self-employed, you get a tax write-off. If you work for a company and they buy it for you, it's not income for you. But if you're just out there and you go out and want to buy a policy, that premium amount is still a taxable income to you, however that came in. So
would you help me, Representative Bruin, understand what Section 2 means? Under what Sub 2 under 1166 means?
Because your Oregon taxable income is based on the federal taxable income. Because I asked the very same question, I want to do this deduct for my state taxable income, and they said, well, this is how you get to that point.
But 2 adds to the federal taxable income. So it makes, when you add something to the federal taxable income and the state thing, that raises revenue. And then somehow it comes back off again in 3. Is that the notion of this?
Mr. Chair, you would have to have LC explain.
Yeah, I think that's an LC question.
But that question was asked more than once. Does this do what I want it to do? And they said, absolutely.
And just as an aside, Mr. Chair, we've seen a similar similar description. Sitting on the Revenue Committee with these sorts of things, you see similar writing that's consistent. Not that that clarifies necessarily, other than to say there is a consistency in how this is done.
Section 2 has the potential to raise revenue, because it adds to the federal taxable income. And when you add to the federal taxable income on the Oregon form, you raise revenue. 9% of X is less than 9% of X plus Y. Well, that's Y is a negative number.
But you reduce.
Okay. Yes, sir.
The intention of this, if I understand it clearly, though, is to reduce the amount of taxable income in Oregon,
state. Right.
That would be the effect if it operates as you imagine.
Via tax credit, right, for purchase of private health insurance.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Can I ask Representative Bruin and Maurer, why this is not a standalone bill, why it's an amendment to 2009? I mean,
because it is a standalone bill that was not heard in this committee. It was referred to this committee, but not heard. And in fact, to give our chair credit, we discussed it, and it just wasn't brought to.
And given that dynamic, Mr. Chair, Representative, given what I think we said, or at least a lot of us have talked about with House Bill 2009, it is a vehicle that does a lot of things. In my mind, first and foremost, what 2009 is designed to do is get more people insured in Oregon, get more people with health insurance and health coverage in Oregon. And once again, given the screwy way, excuse that word, that we currently regulate the tax considerations for health insurance, for the purchase of health insurance, I don't think we can ever get our arms around truly making health care universal, or truly getting our arms around the cost. I mean, another side benefit that we haven't really mentioned is that is a cost reduction benefit, because finally the consumer, I mean, go back to my analogy about being in a restaurant. Why wouldn't you order anything or everything if you have no idea what the cost is? And this at least gives a pathway for the healthcare consumer to truly see and maybe even shop with the best and most cost-effective treatment would be.
Why is that?
Well, because they own the insurance. They're the customer. Right now we have a patient, but the customer is some other entity. The patient, but
all
Providence
this says
is
if you buy your own health insurance, you get to deduct it from your state income
right.
tax.
Right, but you own the insurance at that point. And I guess what I'm saying is that with that ownership maybe comes a little higher level degree of scrutiny and, frankly, understanding of what you're buying and what you're purchasing. It's not, in and of itself, that doesn't get, you know, to the promised land of healthcare by itself, but I think it's an integral step.
Don't these people already own their insurance? There are people buying their own insurance. This would just change their taxes.
This would give individuals
what care they would receive.
Well, I think when you're a company that buys health insurance and you get the tax benefit of that, as you are, I think you look at your policies, what your policies provide, what they don't provide. It's a mix and a balance between what you want to pay and what you want to offer, what you want to offer your employees. The individual, if I'm employed by a company, never has that opportunity. I mean, once again, I'm the patient, but I'm never the customer.
Is this only for individuals, or is this for businesses?
Well, businesses already have the advantage. It's for individuals. Businesses, as I understand it, correct me, Representative Maurer, if I'm wrong, have had this advantage since immediately after or during World War II.
I don't know when it took effect,
yeah.
But
even before that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My back of napkin math, and it's probably wildly inaccurate, but if we're talking about 200,000 Oregonians buying individual insurance, and I don't know if that's right, who would qualify for this deduction, and presuming that they're spending somewhere between $150 and $200 a month, again, that may be too high, so I don't know. But
no, in fact,
it's way too low.
$200 a month?
No, that's right.
Yeah, the state of Oregon pays $1,200 a month.
Right, and I'm talking about individuals who typically are paying much less than the state of Oregon pays. When I had an individual plan, it was under $200 a month. But this, I'm glad I'm using conservative estimates.
Finish your napkin.
So $200 a month, we're talking about a potentially $400 million total. Now, this is deductive, not credit, so take 9% of that would be its net revenue effect, something close to 9% of that, which comes out in this very conservative model at $36 million. So
$36 or $50 million,
yeah,
which it would add to the fiscal on this bill.
It would add, and I would say, thank goodness those people have the tax deduction, and how many more uninsured Oregonians are going to be out purchasing health insurance, because it now, the napkin math works for them to purchase it.
Yeah, I have to say, I think the principle makes sense, and you and I have had this conversation. I just don't want to add a $50 to $100 million fiscal to this bill, which ends up wiping health reform out on this one point. So I would urge a no vote on this, not because it's a bad idea. I think if people end up buying their own health insurance, it is a legitimate, I think it's a legitimate deduction and one we ought to be working on. And let's put it on the agenda for next session. Because I think we want to encourage people to buy their own health insurance if they don't get it as a benefit. That seems obvious to me. I'm sorry, Representative Kenemer, you had a point, please.
Well, I think it's gotten mostly covered. I just wanted to point out this is a deduction rather than a tax credit, and there was some confusion on that matter. I'd like the policy. I mean, we want to encourage people to buy it, and we ought to reward positive behavior.
Yep. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that we've stripped out the coverage and provider tax portions, which, although we're partially recommending the health fund board recommendations, I think we're trying to get a 2009 that stays very close to the health fund board recommendations. I don't think this was a recommendation, no. So that's my one concern. The other issue is I would want us to explore the discussion of means testing this. I'm not sure I would want to give a deduction for folks who are in the 400 or 500% of poverty income bracket. They can purchase, and then you have other folks who... I think there's some tax liability issues based on income that we'd want to probably look into.
Then every corporation that buys health insurance needs to be means-tested, too.
I totally agree with that.
Well, I think...
But that's a federal issue,
about the corporate
and
minimum. Is.
Well, this has been an issue of fairness since it was passed in the law, during World War II or shortly after. Actually, it was after World War II when they passed. I think that we're actually doing a huge disservice to Oregonians, and there's, a bunch of Oregonians that would probably take advantage of it. It doesn't really do much for the cost of health care overall.
The other side of this, the other way to deal with fairness is to make sure that people get taxed on the benefit that they get, so that health insurance isn't a pre-tax dollar, it's a post-tax dollar, and that means whether they pay for it themselves or if they pay for it themselves, that's one thing. If they get it free, then they should be taxed on that. That's another way to work it. I like this model better. But I'm going to ask for a roll call.
Representative Dembrough?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Nope.
Vice Chair Harker?
No.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
No.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
No.
Chair Greenlich?
No. Motion fails, but I really do want to get involved in this discussion and see whether we can do something in this regard, particularly if finances are better in the next, unlikely, in the next session. Mr. Burns, would you come and tell us about the -64s? And while you're at it, you might mention the -65s. But let's start with the -64s.
Mr. Chair, members, Tom Burns, health policy consultant to the chair. The -64 amendments were brought to us by the insurance industry as a means to address a number of technical concerns they found in the bill. The most notable of them was to make it very clear that certain provisions of this bill had to come back to you in the 2011 session for a formal action before they can go into effect. Among those are the public insurance plan, the exchange. It also modified how the statewide drug formulary could be used. And if you give me a minute and I can flip through all my notes here, I could find the actual amendment and point out the rest of them to you. Cleaned up the language around how the authority will work with DCBS on building the methodologies and policies around how to do rate setting.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the -64s?
Mr. Chairman, I might also comment that, am I right, the hand engrossed version that you have in front of you reflect these amendments. And so if you would like, I can point specifically to where they are in the hand engrossed
version. They are in there?
Yes, sir.
Sure. said you could do it.
The first one is on page 7. I apologize, there are no page and line references, but if you read down to K, it now reads, develop and submit a plan to the Legislative Assembly by December 31, 2010, with recommendations, policies, and procedures for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, which means that it is very clear that the exchange will come back to you for consideration. It continues down on L, which is a complete rewrite, develop and submit a plan to the Legislative Assembly by December 31, 2010. Which for the publicly owned health benefit plan, and also requires that plan to include fixed and variable operating as well as capital costs.
Mr. Chair, could I get an interpretation of that last fully allocated fixed and variable operating and capital costs? What does that mean?
It would be my assumption to make it clear that in order to be an insurance plan, you have to be capitalized. Now you can present the argument that the state in and of itself is capitalized.
And it might do that, but that would be in the...
Yeah, it would be in the plan that would come back to you for consideration.
Might say the faith and credit of the state, but for example, SAFE in the workers' compensation business has to create its own reserve. And I don't know how it started, when it started, but it has a very significant reserve. In the cases we said create a plan by December 31st, 2010, that didn't make clear that what we had, at least what I had intended, which was they have the plan ready and then they submit it to the legislature. What we're trying to do here is to make clear that is the intention, that we will have an opportunity to discuss all of these in the 11th session.
Mr. Chairman, just an aside, I just wanted to express my appreciation to staff. I know engrossing this was a huge job. Yeah. And it's just very, very helpful, and I know I was one of the unreasonable people who asked for that. And
I happen
wanted
to
say publicly thanks, because it really helps to see the context.
I think we should make clear. I happen to know that if he wasn't doing this all day Saturday and Sunday, he'd be out working in the garden.
Yeah, he doesn't look sunburned. So.
No, I would have been working with interacting with my sister-in-law, which is
I knew there was something you didn't want to do on the record.
This is
fortunately, she's in Montana.
No, it's all right.
Never hear this.
Tom has been doing an amazing job, and I think probably will continue to be. Okay, can I have a motion on the
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm not quite going to make that motion because I was hoping to hear Tom's the explanation on the very next section of the amendment, the page 8, line 41, which to me appears to be a fairly substantive change.
Are we back? Are we still on page 7?
Page 8.
Hang on a second. I got to catch up with you.
This is DCBS.
This is the DCBS language.
Where are we, guys?
Again, page 8 of the hand engrossed. It's page 8 actually sort of stumbled over into two pages. So it would be I in page 8 where it reads, it now will read, in consultation with the director of DCBS, propose recommended standards and methodologies to the Legislative Assembly for A, review of administrative expenses, B, approval of rates, and C, enforcements of rules adopted by DCBS.
My question, Mr. Chair, is in the meantime, who does health insurance reviews and rate approvals? Does that remain within house within DCBS
yes,
until the authority comes to us in 2011 and says, here's how we would do it in consultation with DCBS if you, 2011 legislature, approve. Is that
no, even the intention here, and this is what's got the governor accepting this, and I think we had this discussion before, that the DCBS will continue to run their black box and do the rate reviews, but it will be against standards and benefit plans adopted by the authority. So what DCBS told us, and they testified to that here, that there are a lot of technical matters about how it's done, and their statement was, we can run rate reviews against any standards, and we do get standards in a variety of places. So the notion is the authority would develop the standards. DCBS would adopt those standards by rule and run the rate reviews against those standards.
I guess my question is process related, and it has to do, A, with this biennium that begins July 1st, and who is doing, whether rate review and approval looks the same during the coming biennium as it did during the current biennium. So that's question A. And question B is whether the legislature then has to approve. This appears to suggest that the legislature in 2011 will need to approve these standards and methodologies.
No,
this is proposed, recommended.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, when this bill goes into effect, DCBS will continue to do all rate settings. Okay. As the authority board comes up with methodologies and standards, proposed recommended standards and methodologies, they will develop them and send them back to you for as an FYI. They will also at the same time send them to DCBS, and DCBS will continue to use them as DCBS currently reviews rates based on the standards and methodologies. It just allows you to look at them and to revisit them should you desire to, but it doesn't require it.
Well, we can't approve rules, remember. There's a separation of authority, but the issue is I don't think we know the answer as to what will happen between now and 2011. It depends on how fast the authority gets to work and create standards. But I would hope before the end of the biennium, standards will have been developed and will be available to for DCBS to do their job. Okay, are we ready for a motion on 6-4?
Mr. Chair, if I can just ask, just... You know, the language there in I says proposed recommended standards and methodologies to the 76th Legislative Assembly. So is that what you were talking about as an FYI, Tom?
Or yes. Yeah.
Because that seems stronger than an FYI to me.
The problem, as the chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, the problem, as the chair points out, is that you don't have the authority to look at a rule. You can look at the standards and undo the law or modify the law, but the rule is going to be sent to DCBS to be used against rate settings. It will also
come. You don't have the authority to change rules or to deny.
Yeah, you can look at
separation of powers. That's an administrative function. Okay.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I would like, if we could keep going, I'm curious to hear about line 15, page 9, line 12. Regarding the statewide drug formulary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, on page 9D, the language currently reads, a statewide drug formulary for use by publicly funded health plans, and this is may be used by publicly funded health plans. The argument was that presented to us is some insurers negotiate drug prices for their entire 6 or 7 million life policy base, even though Oregon may only be part of that piece. They argued that they could get a better price than we could, even if we were negotiating for a million. So they wanted us to say maybe used, and depending upon what it looks like when the prices get negotiated, the publicly funded benefit plans could come into it if, in fact, it is a better savings than the insurance plans can come up with.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Is that within that conversation is occurring within the exchange?
No, sir. This is under the power of the authority. The authority is authorized to.
This happens even without an exchange. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Some of these things happen with or without an exchange.
Can we have the amendment or the? You want me to move it?
Please.
Mr. Chair. Sorry. First time seeing these? I see we're replacing an entire section in 17B, and I'm trying to figure out what the changes are.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, if you look at 17B, which is on page 11, and here I, to be honest, got tired, and it was late, and the sun was shining, and I really wanted to go outside. What the proposed amendment does is if you read in 17B has 1A, shall include consideration of the following, and then it has A through I, and then it comes down to may include the following. What the proposed amendment does is essentially says, shall consider the following, and strikes may include, and renumbers whatever, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, whatever it works out to be after that.
And where is it in the amendment? What are we talking about in terms of the amendment itself?
Bottom of the first page.
First page?
It starts on the bottom of the first page of the amendment and continues through almost the very end of the second page of the amendment.
Is the on page 11
right
piece?
Yes.
Okay. It incorporates this.
Language is exactly the same. Better be, line by line, it's supposed to be. And LC, instead of just simply doing strikeouts, just struck the entire thing and then renumbered the letters.
Okay, are we ready?
No. Because if you look at page 2, there, if I'm reading this correctly, there's a difference between the hand engrossing and what's in A64 here on page 2, line 12. Because it says...
You're right.
We've gone to roll. After much negotiation and coming up with participation,
you're right.
The amendment has switched it back to roll.
You're right. This is one of those problems that we adopted.
Mm-hmm.
The H on page 11 of the hand and gross that is in red, we adopted the H and I versions, which the LC did not have in front of them when they drafted this. Mr. Chair, I don't know how to fix that problem.
And the difference is maximizing the participation rather than maximizing the role?
Yes.
Maybe we back up.
Does that make any difference?
Except, well, there was
really
a fair amount of discussion about it.
There was a lot of discussion on this, for sure.
Really? On the participation versus role?
Well,
it's the private insurance versus the publicly owned. Right, and if you the discussion went along the lines of if you maximize, you can't maximize the role of one without minimizing the role of the other. And so what we were trying to get to was we wanted to embrace both public and private. We wanted to have free competition in there and not favor one over the other. And
help me find this on the hand and gross. What page is that?
It's page 11.
Page 11.
The two versions.
Two thirds of the
H.
way down, red line H.
And I.
H and I.
And I. I've got it.
Okay.
Maximize their participation. And this does.
Right.
And the amendment changes the word participation to the word role.
I'm sorry, what are you showing me?
This is a different version. This is a later version.
Which is what you want. Later than what?
This is the one that has...
We had settled on participation.
Yeah. The book...
Representative Bruin and I and a couple of other folks...
The version in the hand engrossed was closer to the... was a clearer expression of our intention. Wasn't that right?
That was where we settled. And I think I'll agree with yes. There was a clearer expression of what we were after.
I think, Mr. Chair, this is a question for LC because it's the intent on the part of the Dash 64 amendments were not to change H and I. The intent was to
change H and I of what is the question?
Of the amendments that you adopted earlier.
We were just trying to get everything to be shall instead of half being shall and half being may,
yeah.
Correct?
That's what we wanted to accomplish with the
dash
64.
But it has inadvertently accomplished something else.
It amended,
as well.
You have a two conflicting amendments in front of you. Some amendments that you adopted on Friday.
We adopted the tens on Friday.
Did
we adopt them?
It was the 54 that you adopted on Friday.
Oh, man.
Okay, hold on. They warned us about the problem of.
Can we give direction to LC?
Of having conflicting amendments. I have the 54s in front of me. And in that one, there is no I.
Right. It's H in 54.
Yeah. I mean, so.
64 has some time.
Right. 64 is an I, but the Hanning Roast one you just showed me had an I as well.
Oh, I know what I is.
No.
Let's stand at ease and we can figure out what's going on here. Order, please. Hey, guys.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to have a problem with that. Are you paying for the government paying for it?
That's something else we have.
So do I have a little more?
We get the boss, Mr. Bukovian, to talk to us about the clash between 54 and 64, which has already been picked up by revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, there was an earlier discussion about some of the language. I think in the parlance we used it was stepping on each other, that sometimes it amended the same section. In one case, they can actually renumber some of when there's repeat, when the same number is identified or letter for provision in the same amendment, they can just renumber. If there's wording, and this is, again, some interpreting from legislative counsel, that they can kind of basically pick what the committee desires the wording to be if there's a slight variance between the two wording of the amendments. So I would defer to them to come down, except our drafter is out of town today, our primary drafter.
And we'll be out of town on Wednesday as well.
I think coming back Tuesday night.
Is she coming back Tuesday?
Right. So again, if there's numerical or numbering differences between the two of them, that's easily fixable in council. That's somewhat common. If there's a complete difference in the wording between two different amendments, I think they're going to defer back to the committee to decide how they would like to handle that.
Well, it seems like a scribing error, and we intended it to be what's in the 54s and not in the 64s. Correct. Is there a way to put that on the record? They're going to have to put all this stuff together anyway.
Right.
It's on the record.
Mr. Chair?
It's on the record.
Yes.
In ancient history, we used to make conceptual amendments as a regular way to deal with this, and then if legislative council had an absolute conniption, they came back.
They stamped that out.
So that's one good practice gone away?
They said you can do a conceptual amendment at this level.
Yeah.
When we say we mean maximize participation, not maximize role.
Well, there's
role.
No disagreement. This panel has had this discussion. That was the wording, and that wording was previously drafted. I mean, we're not drafting new language. We're simply correcting a scrivener's error.
Would you see if you can get Dexter to join us? Dexter's not there either.
No, Marissa. Marissa James, I think, is the person to call. I think it's her last name.
Mr. Chair, you're also going to run into the same problem when you look at the dash 65s, because the dash 65 is where the line I comes from. And so you've now got three amendments all working in the same section. One amendment rewrites the entire thing simply as ease of writing. And the 54 stuck H in, and the 65 is going to stick I in when you come to that.
And that rewrote it in the...
The 64 rewrites everything, as opposed to...
But not the 65?
The 65 just adds a line.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I would guess that the problem is less with the dash 65 since it's an addition, not a contradiction, and we've done that continually, even when we're working on the same sections. So,
would it solve the problem that we're raising here if we noted that the word participation as opposed to role is what is? Does that take care of the problem for everybody? Okay. Well, let's adopt 64 with the understanding that that is a conceptual problem. We'll ask the LC to join us and see if that suffices, or whether they want to take these back and rewrite them over that one word. We haven't told a single word. If we're clear, works fine.
It is more than one word.
It is quite a sentence.
Because it says, yeah, that strikes in the development of benefit packages as well.
I'm sorry, what's the problem?
Well, it's
more than just
the difference between the H that's striked and the new H is more than just the change from role to participation. It clarifies it, cleans it up. As well.
We're looking at the 64s. Which cleans it up, the 64s or the 54s?
No, the 54s had a clear expression of, I think, the same idea, but it did more than just change role to participation.
Come on. Do we solve the problem by not having the new H? Does the old H do the job?
Here's the
problem.
Yeah, I doubt
that I can answer your question. The old H talks about the role.
We have adopted other amendments.
You know, I'm sorry.
Okay, so Laura, you got the question left.
Yeah, 54 is different than the...
Our question is...
Digging in my heels.
We adopt this amendment.
We're back at ease.
Action that would have changed.
I think we want to wait till Wednesday anyway, because I think there are two more bills in the Senate that we would like to put into this if we can get them prepared by Wednesday to put them in. And if we can clean this up, if we can find out what it is, if we can make clear what it is we want, that would be good. And then we'll hold the 64s and the 65s for Wednesday and try and get those two bills in, and we'll see if we can get something that cleans it up. Now, can I have some comment on what it is which it is we want here?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we want the language that we adopted Friday in the dash 54, which is the same language as that is in the hand-engrossed 2009 there's two line H's on page 11. The line H that's not stricken is the one we want adopted.
It's not.
What are we looking at here?
So either look at the dash 54 or look at page 11 in the hand engrossed.
So it's not the one in the stricken out.
No, it's the one not stricken.
It's the one in the not stricken. It's the red one. Maximize the participation of private insurance plans offered through the exchange.
Correct.
And in that case, the only difference between the 54 and the 64 is
that one sentence.
Is the I lost it. It's on page 2, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's line 12 on page 2, which maximize. Well,
yeah,
so this question about the development of benefit packages and all that, that's not what we intended.
Stuff, yeah.
Okay. So if we can make clear that is what we want in terms of getting a new thing that substitutes for 64 and 65, if we can do that, we'll do that. And if we can get the two Senate bills in the form of this, the database and the one that's coming, I think they're both coming out tomorrow, I heard.
Right.
Then we'll include those as well on Wednesday. If we can't, we won't include those. But we will be able to hold off and get this one straightened out. Does that work?
Works for me. Just so, Lori will be back tomorrow night, I think, so I'll be doing them for you. So make
good.
Sure you give me clear instructions so that I know what I'm doing.
Tom, are you?
Yes, sir.
And those two other bills, we hope, as
yes.
well.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
What other amendments do we have? We
well,
have
Mr.
also.
Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So I think I understand why we're making this all required, going back to the idea that there's not permissive language left in terms of things that would be considered in the mm-hmm. development of the exchange. My assumption is that the folks who were suggesting these felt that to do the exchange properly, they wanted to make sure we reviewed all of these versus possibly only some of them in the May category. Was that the general conversation, since we don't have anyone necessarily testifying on the amendments?
I'm not sure which May and show we're talking about.
Well, in the exchange in 17B, what the change that we're looking at here is no longer do we have shall include for consideration.
Oh.
All the items are now required to be considered versus might be considered.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we just wanted to make... I don't know where we started. I don't know where the may and shall came from.
I don't know.
I mean, I think these are all things that need to be considered. You can ignore them and you can not do them. But, I mean, I think there's just two categories of things you need to take into consideration for the plan.
Okay.
I think at one time the shall had things that were starting before 2011 when we decided not to get in arguments about those. Those were the things that we took out so that they'd all be a part of the plan. That I do remember.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Okay. How about the 66s? Mr. Denver, do you want to talk about the 66s?
Sure. Amendment 66 sets up the Healthcare Workforce Strategic Fund, which will be the fund that will pay for all those great initiatives that I shared with you. So this will be the repository for federal money and other money, private money. I would be happy to pledge $5 to go into this fund just to get it started. This will be the fund that will be set up in conjunction with the Healthcare Workforce Council to deal with the critical shortage of healthcare workers.
Okay.
Why do we have to have a separate fund?
This would be a strategic fund that could be, where the authority could apply for federal grants, for example, through the stimulus package and other sources.
Education grants and other places.
Yeah. And that then, could be used in a strategic way.
It makes them other funds rather than
general fund.
By the general fund.
If they come from other sources.
Tom, can I have you back? Okay, any discussion on the 66s? Any object? Yes.
Do we need to move it? I didn't actually move it.
Would you?
Yes, please. Mr. Chair, I move Amendment 66 to House Bill 2009A, dated 4/20/09.
Any objections? So moved. Tom, I'd like to go back to 65. 65 does some important things, right?
Yes, sir.
Now, what does it do that's bad?
If you wait, hang on a second while I get it in front of me. The only thing that it does is it adds that one sentence on page 11.
After line 32?
Yes.
It adds the I to that list, but we don't have a problem with the I, is that right?
We don't have a problem with the I, and I think okay. You can go ahead and add the I, and I will work with LC to use that as the basis for which they redraft the 64.
Good. And Section 12A is an important piece.
Yes, sir.
You want to tell us what 12A does on that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, it has been brought to our attention by Uber that there are federal grant monies out there that can be used to offset some of the administrative costs associated with the creation of the authority. And by putting these languages in, it specifically allows the authority to apply for these grants that can be used to help offset any cost associated with the creation of this authority. I don't know why the words are there. Janine is in the audience and can help explain it, but these were their words, and it's it is essentially the opportunity to apply for grants.
Which have huge matching funds.
5-to-1 ratio.
Okay.
At least 5 bucks.
Anybody have a problem? We'll get Dr. Smith to join us. All right, can I have a motion on the 65s, please?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash 65 amendments to House Bill 2009A, dated April 20th, 2009.
Any objection?
So we have three different sections in this amendment, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes,
yeah.
Ma'am.
So we have something around portability plans that is added as a criteria to be reviewed in the exchange, correct? That's the portion at the bottom.
Right.
Does the item at the top, guide and support community three share agreements, does that come from any particular piece of legislation?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kotek, it was one of the options proposed that we could explore. Then there is also complementary legislation introduced by Senator Telfer around this issue as well. So it's complementary, not knowing whether that one goes or doesn't go, but it allows you to explore that as an option, that you could get some modeling dollars or that sort of thing. But the more, not only do you need matching funds to be competitive for these grants, but you need some statutory language to be competitive as well.
Thank you, because I support Senator Telfer's bill, and I wanted to make sure that this was helpful.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Are you ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What is three share?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, it's a term that's been used as a partnership. What they are potentially hoping to do in the Bend area, and what's been done in Muskegon. What state is Muskegon in? Michigan.
Michigan.
Muskegon, Michigan, is they try to get three different partners. So the employer puts up some dollars.
No,
the employee puts up the partners.
Oh. What does three share mean? Is
three
it a ship. New word?
Three.
Is it?
No, it's the three different partners paying
so
for
it. If you had a fourth partner, they're like...
It's a new word.
Yeah, I mean... If
so why can we have, like...
Multi-share?
Multi-share agreements.
The term in Nathanson's bill is multi-share, so that you could have more than...
If we had five partners, they couldn't... This language would exclude them? Two of them are... I don't know. Somewhat facetiously, but I don't know. Sorry,
it's a good point, and we might want to think about the word multi-share there, but I don't know what
maybe
the... I hate to have to amend...
All right,
the whole
well, let's not reason. Adopt it. And
no.
While you're straightening out, make that multi-share.
We can always make that change in Ways and Means if you want to, Mr.
Oh. Okay. You want to make the change here? Or?
I don't care.
All right, well, let's go then. Let's have a motion for this amendment.
Yeah.
For dash 65s. Any objections? Dash 65 is in. 69, Tom, tell us about that.
Mr. Chair, members,
we're done.
69 is the rewrite of 44 that you rescinded at the beginning of your session today. Simply allows for the creation of products designed to address the small group market.
Any discussion? Any objection? We have A69. All right. I'm going to close this now. Tom will continue to work with LC. We'll have a redo of 64. And if we can get them ready, we'll have two more bills out of the Senate. And we'll hold House Bill 2009 over. Carry it over until Wednesday. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2009. And we'll open a work session. Representative Kenemer? No, there he is. Open up a work
session. Mr. Chairman, could we take another bill first? I want to check on something.
Sure. Okay. Let's take House Bill 2535. Open a work session on House Bill 2535. That's a voluntary prescription bill. We were just waiting for a fiscal on that. And I would like a motion on House Bill 2535, please.
Wait, Mr. Chair, don't we have an
amendment? Is it an amendment?
We have a dash 3 amendment.
Right.
I was going to move.
Oh, I thought we did those amendments. What are the amendments?
How about, well, look at them first or have a motion on place?
No,
one of them is the one that Representative Garrett.
Mr. Chair, at the last work session on this, a concern was expressed about the liability provision.
Right.
Representative Cannon and others, and you asked me to work with counsel on that. 2531.
And dash 2 certainly won't have a...
Dash 3.
Relationship. And that's the dash 3 that you're talking about.
I think the only change that was made is on page 5. Line 7, subsection 2. The liability immunity was rephrased to reference good faith participation in the program so that a good faith participant will not be liable for participating in the program. That's essentially all it says. The objective is to make sure that tort liability is not increased simply because somebody participates in good faith in this program. Nor is it to decrease tort liability.
The dash 2 is basically a rewrite of the bill, is that right?
The dash 3, okay. Yes.
The dash 3 is
May I
go ahead, talk to us.
When we say it's a rewrite, it's my understanding we still need the dash 2 amendment also. Is that true, Representative Garrett?
Dash 3.
They are close.
The dash 2 is what was before you at the last.
I don't know. I thought the dash 3 replaced the dash 2, but I'm not positive that.
Look, they're identical up until.
So the only difference seems to be on line 12 of page 5. In the dash 2, it's been changed.
Did we move the dash 2?
Line which?
The dash 11 and 12 on page 5.
So we asked council to redraft it. So I thought the dash 3 replaced
this change to right lines. No, I'm sorry. That's in the dash 3. It's 10 and 11 in the dash 2.
I cannot find dash 3s. Can I borrow somebody's dash 3?
Probably does, because it's new language from the dash 2.
Okay.
And what do we think is the difference between 2s and 3s?
It looks just like the dash 2 does replace the dash 3 because the dash...
The dash 2 replaces the dash 3?
The dash 3 replaces the dash...
We don't need the 2s. All we need is the 3s.
And what is the difference between the 2s and the 3s?
The only difference, Mr. Chair, is on page 5 in that subsection 2.
Page 5. This is talking about good faith.
Well, does it have it in there anywhere? I don't even see the good page.
Okay. So, let's have a motion on the dash threes.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash threes to House Bill 2535, dated April 17, 2009.
Is there any discussion on the dash threes? Is there any objection? Dash threes are now a part of House Bill 2535. Can I have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, as I move House Bill 2535 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenmer?
Aye.
Representative Krotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill goes to the floor with a due pass. I assert that the dash threes are the same as the dash twos in all material ways. So we have a floor pass, and we'll ask.
Well, we have a fiscal to the dash.
The threes? Okay. And we will ask. Representative Gelser has asked me five times, and her staff came in today to ask me. I told her if they asked me one more time, I was going to rescind my agreement that she'd carry it. Turned out she hasn't been back in the last hour, so Representative Gelser will carry the bill on the floor. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2535. Are you ready?
I think so. We have one possible language issue, but other than that, yes. I'm sorry.
I will open a work session on House Bill 2702. Is that right?
Yep.
2702. Representative Kenmer, you want to guide us through this right now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that, you know, with the dash three amendments, which we've already inserted, it's just about ready to go, but it's been brought to my attention by Representative Thompson that there is a language issue, and we may need to consider that as a change. It's an error in that it says, and I can't find my copy of the bill. Amongst all my paper.
You need the bill?
Yeah, here, Jim's got it marked. That's... it is in Section 7, over on page 5 of the original bill, lines 11, 12, and 13. You'll recall that there was some concern and misrepresentation last time on the issue about the treatment of children. This bill provides under this that it can only be done in consultation in providing medication for a child in consultation with a psychiatrist. But it's just been brought to my attention. It's a psychiatrist who is certified or eligible to be certified by the Oregon Medical Board. It is not the Oregon Medical Board that does that certification. And so this is just brought to my attention a matter of minutes ago. Otherwise, I thought everything was in order. So we need
certified.
An amendment.
Say that again.
It says the language here, certified by the Oregon Medical Board, and my understanding is that psychiatrists are not certified by the medical board, but by a national association in child psychiatry. Have I gotten that correctly? Is Mr. McCulley here or somebody who can you speak to that, please? If Mr. Chairman, can you?
Yeah, they're board certified by a separate board.
Yes, and it's so it's miswritten, is what my I believe that is correct. And obviously, we can't have something that's wrong written
right.
in the statute.
You get another amendment.
I will get another amendment
the
to clarify
American
that.
The American College of Psychiatry, I think. I think it's by the American College of Psychiatry.
Okay.
Close the
thank
work
you
session.
Very much for the courtesy. We'll get this draft.
We'll be back. We will carry House Bill 2007 over until...
2702.
I mean, 2702 over until Wednesday. Yeah. I think I've carried it over once already. Carry it over again. Representative Thompson, are you ready to talk to us about...
No, that's not bugging me. Is that bugging me?
About... Now, that's the only bill we have,
these
right?
These are the two that we can still move.
Which two?
925, which is the 90-day prescription.
31
the other
and
one?
3103. And...
Oh, that's the one I was looking for. 3103. Let me open a work session on 3103. Do we have any amendments to do on 3103?
Mr. Chair, I think we looked at those on Friday. So remember, the amendment at the request of the governor's office takes the stipulation was taken out of the statute that they post a sign about generic substitution. The governor's office asked that that not be taken out. Therefore, the amendment puts that sign back in, which has no consequence because the sign's already hung on the wall. So we're talking about whether they take the sign down or don't take the sign down. It doesn't affect anything.
Will you move that amendment, please?
Is that a dash 3?
It's a dash 1.
Dash 1, okay. I move that we include the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3103 as part of the bill.
Is there any discussion about that?
About the dash 1?
Pardon me?
About the dash 1s.
About the dash 1s. Okay, dash 1s are a part of 3103. We have a motion on the bill.
I move House Bill 3103 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, this is a, like 11th hour comment, but is anyone here from the Board of Pharmacy? Because what caught me in the staff measure summary was this would allow provided rules by the Board of Pharmacy to approve dispensing drugs by vending machines. And I guess I just, that's really interesting. So, and maybe,
talk to us?
Why would we want to do that at all?
Why do we want
it doesn't
to do
say,
that?
Well, because if I, on page 7, colleagues, it says, under section 6, right now the law says no drug shall be dispensed to the public by means of automatic vending machines. We're changing it to read, except as approved by rule by the State Board of Pharmacy, a person may not dispense drugs to the public by means of an automatic vending machine. So I'm not necessarily opposed.
Jim, you want to talk about
it?
I think part of that is we've already been doing it. There have been some pilot programs in Oregon using various prototype vending machines in physicians' offices and elsewhere. This clearly puts it under the purview of the Board of Pharmacy that if we're going to do that, there have to be rules. The Board of Pharmacy is the place to do the rules. But I don't believe the intent was the Board of Pharmacy is going to necessarily do that, but it stipulates that no one's going to do it if we don't have rules.
Okay.
Is that close?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotick, I'm Paige Clark with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, and yes, that is absolutely well represented by Representative Thompson, so that it reads except as approved by rule by the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, and technology is constantly changing. There are some elements of technology that may fall under this category, not to say that vending machines are going to sort of start popping up throughout. That's exactly the opposite of the intent of this. But I think the Oregon Board of Pharmacy clearly able to write rule and have exceptions, et cetera, for particular pieces of technology which are changing very, very fast.
Maybe an example?
Yeah,
there's technology around the country. It's been tested in a number of formats now. For instance, you can go to your doctor and he or she will give you a prescription, and then you go back out into the waiting room and put your Visa card in the machine, which identifies you and ties you back to a physician's order on his or her computer, and the machine will dispense a 30-day supply to you and charge it to your card. Now, to my knowledge, all of these are just conceptual testing sorts of things, but it begs the question of if we set up hospital doctor's office or potentially kiosk distribution, who's going to be in charge of this technological development?
And this particular caveat here says it will be the purview of the Board of Pharmacy, like any other pharmaceutical distribution. And of course, they have the right to put the nix on it, too, if it isn't safe or whatever.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
So if I have a clear, if you have a cigarette, which is going to be a prescription drug and a 21 and over bar,
yeah.
We can,
outside
we're prohibiting the vending machine.
Outside of 21 over.
Unless the Board of Pharmacy decides to pass rules to allow you to...
For cigarettes.
For smoking.
That's probably an unfortunate example, but...
that would be the... I mean, that's right, a perfectly placed for the vending machine.
Thank you, if I'm excused from the hot seat. Thank you, Representative.
We have a motion on the table. Is there any more discussion? Would you please take the roll?
Vice Chair Harger?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye. Vice Chair Maurer? Aye. Representative Thompson? Aye. Representative Bruin? Aye.
Representative Cannon? Aye.
Representative Dembrough? Aye. Representative Guerin? Aye. Chair Greenlee? Aye. Motion carries. Senator Thompson, will you carry this?
I would be honored.
Thank you. I would like to open a hearing, a work session on House Bill 2057, and ask Mr. Powers to join us, provide some data. When we first heard this bill about semi-independent agencies, there was a lot of discussion about the reason you wanted semi-independent agencies is because they were more efficient. They could operate more efficiently. So we decided to ask LFO to get us some data on it. We did a little analysis, and I would like to ask Mr. Powers to talk to us about the analysis he did on the data relative to House Bill 2057.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Powers, Legislative Director for the Chair. Wanted to present some information to you at the request of the Chair and with the assistance of the Legislative Fiscal Office regarding the 11 semi-independent boards generally and the 3 semi-independent boards that the bill, House Bill 2057, relates to, the Optometry Board, the Board of Massage Therapists, and the Physical Therapist Board, which are three of the 11 semi-independent boards. The other 8 boards are not healthcare related, and while some of them do license professionals, they do not, as far as I know, license healthcare professionals. The information from this table was collected from the semi-independent board reports over the 2005-2007 biennium, which was information that the general public learned in December 2008, so we didn't know what the boards were doing from July 1st, 2005 to June 30th, 2007 until December 2008, and that is the information that you have in front of you, their budget actuals, the number of positions and board members, not board members, but the number of employees and FTEs that represent the number of licensees. And then those I added by way of calculation in public records. Some of them were in this report. Some of them are just generally available, the salaries of the executive directors. LFO provided the fees for the base licenses. Some of this information is also included in a report that you all should have received sometime at the beginning of this biennium, or at the beginning of the session, Review of Semi-Independent Agency Reports, published December 2008. That was printed by the Legislative Fiscal Office. The semi-independent boards are not required to present you, legislators, with information unless you are the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate. All other 88 members of the legislature need to wait for LFO to compile the information and get that to you. So it takes you about a year longer to get that information than other legislators, and that's if the boards submit their report on time. But just to go over the numbers really quick, you can see that LFO picked out 4 boards that are what they determined to be similar in scope and size and practice to the 3 semi-independent boards, I'm not sure how they exactly relate one by one, but if you were to match them up by size, you could look up the optometry board versus the occupational therapy board, the board of dentistry versus the massage therapist board, and the PT board versus something like the clinical social workers board or the chiropractic examiners. But if you wanted to look at the classes of boards generally based on what was picked out versus the three semi-independent boards, you'll see that per licensee, the cost of the semi-independent boards is actually about $25 higher per licensee. So based on this table, the argument that semi-independent boards save the state money is not accurate. In fact, the semi-independent boards pay their executive directors an average of $20,000 better than the boards that are compiled here. So that's $60,000 total and above average salaries when you're comparing semi-independent boards to boards that are, like every other agency in the state, regulated and come to the Ways and Means Committee. If you calculate the number of licensees that are licensed by the semi-independent boards and then you multiply that by the cost savings you would get if these boards were regulated by the legislature, just like every other agency, you would get a total cost savings of $284,000 or $284,072.31. And I don't know what argument you'd like to make on how to spend that money, but you could get at it by passing this bill, hypothetically. With that, I just want to go over some of the findings of LFO for the 2005-2007 biennium, and then I'll take some questions. Unless you want to interrupt me, that's fine, too.
May I interrupt?
Yes.
Just when you say savings, it's really the savings would go back to the licensees.
Okay.
It's not savings to the state that can be diverted, no matter how much we'd want to sweep out of there, which we're really good at sweeping odd accounts.
Well, you ain't seen nothing yet.
All right. Interesting.
Great.
But there's no, I mean, it would just, they're, they would have.
Would save money for the licensees, which is not a bad idea.
This is Chair Representative Maurer, that's correct. I mean, you could do it either way. If we were to do this, we could do a sweep. Another thing that the LFO report found is that agencies, when they submit their report, they don't clearly identify what the starting or ending fund balances are, so we don't necessarily know how much these boards have to sweep at any given time, because as LFO states, the information provided by boards and semi-independent boards, including the three that we're talking about today, are pretty varied, and the information that's provided is sometimes insufficient to answer the questions of LFO when you're comparing it to what, you know, the board of nursing or the Oregon Medical Board, et cetera, might provide. And this is information not provided to legislators, but solely to the fiscal office and the presiding officers and the governor.
Basically, the point is that when the other boards present to the legislature, present to Ways and Means, they present their performance on key performance measures, they decide whether those key performance measures goes forward, they talk about the reserves of the board, which is generally expected to be about a six-month operating reserve, and their performance and their budgets are reviewed more or less strictly. I think more strictly now than they once were, but the fact is the semi-independents have no restrictions. They don't have to follow state policies on salaries and on hiring and on purchasing. And their argument is that's the right thing because there's so much more cost-effective, and now I don't see any evidence except their assertion that they're cost-effective, and perhaps there's some evidence that they're not. So I sense there wasn't a lot of interest in this committee to move this bill forward, but now that you've had some information, and if there's any more we can get to you, I'd like you to rethink it again and decide whether there is a reason to bring these boards back under the aegis. And if it's for no other reason than to make sure they're performing adequately and they're doing everything they can to conserve the resources of their licensees that pay the board. And as one board executive said, the problem is if we do this, they won't be able to run it, their agency, as a small business. And as I pointed out, to that person. Small businesses fail at a very high rate, and this is not a business that already runs a small business. So if we want to be provide some oversight to them, I think this would be a useful step. And if the committee doesn't feel that way, I'm perfectly happy. The world, as we know, will not come to an end if we don't move in this direction. So I wanted to have this information out there. We'll think about it. Let me know what you would like to do. I'll move this this bill. I'll carry it over, and we can decide at the next session or informally whether it's something that you think we should move forward or whether we have more important things to be doing with our time between 3 and 6 or 3 and 8 or whatever it is. We've got a lot of work to do. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I have a little bit of problem with this bill because it appears from everything I could find the semi-independent boards are functioning well. And we have a lot of parts of state government that are not functioning well. And this might be a time to put a little bit more emphasis there, come back and revisit this sometime in the future if there's a reason to. But, and again, even the numbers, there are different numbers of members, different issues they have to address, things like that. Some of them are heavier into funding education for their members than others are. So I'm not sure that even the comparisons are direct enough.
I would ask, how do you know they're functioning well? I mean, that's the question. The question is, maybe they are. Maybe they're wonderful.
I assume
they assert they are.
That we would hear from constituents or their own members if they were not, because I certainly do about some of the other boards.
We hear a lot about at least one of those boards.
No. I haven't, but I would defer to you.
We've been hearing a lot about one of the boards. Representative Denbrough?
My question, really more question at this point than a comment, along the same lines as Representative Thompson. That is, I'm wondering, is there an avenue if a licensee had cause to complain about the amount of their license? Is there a forum where licensees are engaged, in this question of, you know, how much they're paying and what they're getting for it, et cetera? Or is the assumption that this is a state mandate and this is what I'm charged, this is what I pay, and there's really no avenue for them to complain, essentially? Because it doesn't sound as if we've heard a lot of complaints, although, Chair Greenlick, you have heard complaints, apparently.
The only avenue to complain is to the board itself.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Denbrough, that is correct. It's similar to a state agency filing administrative rule revision or creating a new rule. There has to be the same procedure followed in that instance where a new rule is set. I think it's just like any other rule setting process where there's notice and then hearing, and then they carry forward and either adopt that rule or revise it or do not adopt the rule. I guess the question posed is whether these boards are viewed as a service for the professionals who are licensed and pay the fees, or whether the public needs to have some input onto the funding question of the board, and whether the other funds in question are sufficiently giving the board enough revenue to pursue public protection and education and all the things that boards need to do to fulfill their mission statement, whether that should be just something that goes out in a professional board's newsletter, or whether in the legislative process it's something available for all Oregonians to see and have an opportunity to comment on in a bigger forum.
So, Kotick, I'm a freshman in the Ways and Means Subcommittee, just having reviewed the medical board and the nursing board, but you've been involved in this. Can you talk about at least the level of oversight that Ways and Means does for the other boards?
Well, they are subject to the different types of budget preparation through DAS. They would not be in semi-independence. We usually do at least a day, if not more, of public hearing and then take public testimony. Legislative Fiscal does a recommendation on their budget. The agencies also prepare policy option packages like other agencies to the governor's office. So there's just a lot more process involved.
Comment to that? Sorry. Yeah. He grunted. I heard him. So.
All right. You get it first. You grunted first.
Okay. So having, being also a newbie to the whole process, including the general government subcommittee of Ways and Means, and having sat through that process with a number of boards so far.
It's a value-neutral discussion.
It's, the value is debatable. It's at times painful. There is a tremendous amount of discussion and or there's a tremendous amount of listening and really not much substantive review at times, especially in the case of some of these smaller boards. I find the process extremely inefficient. And yeah. I would not be a strong proponent of bringing these boards into that process.
Would you be a strong opponent?
I don't care.
Is it a weak yes or a weak no?
You raised the notion of whether we should be doing other more important things. And I would say, yeah, we should.
I do think there's a reluctance on the folks in the subcommittees to, there's this weird kind of, well, there are other funds and there are fees raised by practitioners, whether or not we should, you know, do too much with their budget, and I think it depends on who you're talking to. And so I think that's a little bit of the, we listen to all this information, we look at their budgets, and then we go, well, but since it's not general fund,
yeah,
as long as they have an ending balance and they seem to be running fine, all is well in the world. But I wanted to just...
And they met their key performance.
And they met their key performance.
Which they almost never meet all of them.
Mm. And Tom, you might have mentioned this last time, I can't remember, but in the report from LFO, they recommend one piece of legislation around when audits should be produced, I think. I'm trying to... Do you know if that ever got introduced? At the back of the report, there's an LC 1595. They had it drafted as an agency bill.
Chair Green, like Representative Kotek, I believe that has been introduced and probably was referred by the Speaker back to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. However, I don't know that they have taken any affirmative action on policy bills at this point, since this is more of a procedural bill that would probably take effect. I don't know how much urgency there is, because, quite frankly, we won't be seeing the next batch of reports until April 2010 for what has been occurring from July 1st, 2007 until June 30th of this year. We won't be seeing that until April, because I think the deadline has been extended. And even then, you can have older audits, because not always will you have an audit that is within that biennium, is my understanding from reading this report. I might be reading that wrong, but I think LFO has recommended that even if you submit your report, the soonest you get your audit is, even if it's after that April 1st deadline, then you should submit the most recent audit as a supplement to the semi-independent board report.
Follow up. I mean, I do think some of the timing of when the audits and when the reports are made seems really off in terms of how long we wait for some of this. And I noticed, I think we had talked earlier on that the semis they get their audits through the Secretary of State's office. If they're supposed to be running, like, they're semi-independent, why don't they just do like, say, nonprofits do and go out and get that audit and get it in a heck of a lot quicker? There just seems to be a lot of gap here. But that's not enough for me to support taking away their semi-independent status, but I do think it's something we need to look at.
Yeah, and the problem is LFO doesn't have any authority to do anything. So they get the report, they get it a year or two late, and they get it. And
I don't think it's going to change the outcome based on my, very, arguably, very limited experience.
Mr. Chair, if I may speak to
Mine's is limited
your remark. In the report, to point out the example of the lack of positive authority of LFO. LFO provided information about the batch of reports for the 2003 to 2005 biennium in 2006, and then LFO says, LFO's 2006 report to the legislature regarding the semi-independent board reports made some suggestions for future agency reports. However, not all agencies implemented the suggestions. As a result, one of the products of this review was a development of a guidance document for future reports. So instead of taking positive action, it seems to be providing suggestions and moving them along the path.
Well, I will close this work session and take information from you. If the committee thinks this is worthwhile to move it on, we'll move it on to Ways and Means. And if the committee does not think it's worthwhile, we will not move it on to Ways and Means. So I will...
Have you carried this bill?
No, I haven't yet. So I will carry this bill over, and I will try and... Maybe I'll ask Mr. Powers to check in with you guys, and if it is not of interest to do this, we will kill it on Wednesday.
Secret ballot?
Oh, you have some...
Employee free choice.
Doesn't that... Yeah. It can be secret. He doesn't have to tell me. I don't feel very strongly either. I just think, you know, through that whole interim, we looked at the question of board oversight. And with most boards, there's no oversight except the boards. And this board, there isn't even LFO oversight, so it strikes me. And I don't think they're bad. I just think we ought to have oversight of things that regulate these health professions. It's not a trivial issue. We have a couple of letters on this one. Is that right?
We have a letter dated January 21st, 2009 from Health Services Committee, signed by Heather Benori. And we have a letter dated April 19th from the American Academy of Pediatrics, signed by Dr. David W. Willis.
On this bill?
No, that's on 27.
It sounds like the wrong bill.
Excuse me. That was on 2702. If we can...
Okay. All right. You have a letter. We have received letters.
The letter from the Health Services Committee is on 2050.
That's to us, the Health Services Committee.
Right.
Who's the letter from?
Heather Benori.
Who is?
She is the AMTA liaison to OBMT. OBMT Rules Committee representative for OMTA.
Okay. I can tell you, I think it's official, all three of the boards suggest we not pass this. I will close this work session on House Bill 2057. Have we carried everything over we need to carry over,
now,
Madam Administrator?
We could pass out 2925 if we want to have those ready to go.
I'll open a work session on House Bill 2925 and see if there is interest on the committee. I've not polled the committee. Is there interest on the committee in passing House Bill 2925? Representative Thompson, do you want to start the discussion on this? That's the 90-day supply, the health insurance.
Okay, this particular bill, as it sits now, if you order prescriptions through mail order, you can get a 90-day supply.
If your doctor writes for
you. If your doctor writes that for you. However, if you get your prescription filled at a local pharmacy, most insurance companies, but not all, won't honor a 90-day supply through that route. So you can only get a 30-day supply, and you end up paying additional copays for each of the 30 days. So it levels the playing field. I'm not sure it's earth-shaking legislation, but it levels the playing field among the various pharmacy providers for those services. And it makes it, frankly, more convenient for patients, too.
Is there an amendment on this bill?
We don't have an amendment, but there was some discussion. There were some members of the committee and from the gentleman from ODS. They can already, there are through the mail orders that they are basically, that allows them to do the 90-day.
Yeah, that's what said.
And so, you know, the question is whether there was some discussion about the bill being amended, but I haven't seen an amendment. So.
Well, the issue is that the insurance carriers say that this is a mechanism to move people towards a more efficient way of getting coverage.
No, I think they would argue it's if you can it's cost savings if you can use mail order when you can use mail order.
That's what I was saying. But to move people toward mail order because it is a cost saving. I think that's what ODS testified. We have a couple of other representatives out there. And I'm not sure they think this is a nerve-shattering thing either, but...
No. Mr. Chair, I'm in...
Talk about it. Mr. Powell, you want to talk about it? You want to talk about it? Come and talk to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey on behalf of ODS. The situation is that with regard to, at least on the ODS standpoint, the discounts on mail order are substantial off of average wholesale price, which is 14% less that. It is significant for generics, not as significant for brand. And so it's one of those situations where it lowers cost by, quite frankly, driving as many individuals to mail order. That's a fact. So it does have an impact, at least on the Oregon Educators Benefit Board that we administer. The financial is not significant. It's a part of the. It's significant in the sense that it would lower our, if you will, our discounts, we believe, as individuals drive to the 90-day supply at retail. Now, I can understand why individuals want a 90-day supply at retail. Notwithstanding that, there are, at least with regard to our network, as people are traveling, there are pretty much everywhere in the country you can get your prescription filled. If somebody wants a 90-day supply for a reason of travel or whatever, we have a provision which they can apply for that, and they would receive that depending on the circumstances if they're going on vacation. Quite frankly, if somebody's going on, let's say, a mission for a year in another country, they get a year's supply of their medicine. So there are opportunities. I do know in talking to Representative Krieger, he was trying to figure out a way for seniors to be able to move in this direction. It's somewhat difficult for us, and I anticipated that might be the amendment, and I just had let him know that is somewhat problematic to code all of the individuals over 65 and under 65. We do provide a 90-day supply for the Medicare Part D side of PERS that we're involved in. But I understand where you want to come from in the standpoint of ease, but it does have a financial impact.
Mike, do you oppose the bill? Or sort of prefer not to have it?
ODS would prefer not to have this bill.
Could you charge more for a 90-day supply at a retail? Does this bill prohibit
you? You can charge the copay 30 days at a time in either case.
But this bill would not prohibit that practice.
Mr. Chair, that is the case. Again, as we pointed out to you and the sponsor of the bill, that quite frankly, it needs to be amended because it isn't drafted correctly to do what the sponsor wants it to do. Notwithstanding what you'd like to do, it's not drafted correctly.
Okay. Mr. Powell?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Powell representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chair, members, you have a letter from Regents in opposition to the bill. The primary reason is the increased cost due to waste in the system. And what Regents did was looked at their mail order program and determined a certain percentage of waste based upon changes in prescriptions and in that period, and concluded that a fiscal on the PEB program that we're part of would exist to the tune of about $2.5 million. People who are, and it's in the letter, Mr. Chairman, if you want to look at it. It's
other letter. I just puzzled over it.
I'm puzzled over it.
Well, it may, it's, may, ask, not, not, may not be drafted well, but that's the...
How come the cost, or the cost of this is the same for PEB as it is for OWEB? When PEB has, when the number of lives covered is substantially different.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I can't speak for OWEB.
Because OWEB, and they refer to a $2.5 million cost in OWEB. But just,
Mr. Chairman, I would...
Maybe that's the number of the data.
I would say that reading is more efficient.
Well,
Mr. Chair,
nice job. That was good. That was good. We just...
Sure, I object.
You get paid those big bucks for that, yeah. Senator Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think this bill changes the world and would be fine if we don't deal with it. But it raises some interesting questions. So you're saying there's medical waste. There's a projected medical waste of 4% or something. No medical waste in the folks who purchase 90 days through mail order? The reason I ask is because this raises issues for me. I'm like, so maybe the doc shouldn't be doing 90-day prescriptions. And what is it about the folks who do the 90-day mail order that they don't waste their drugs? I mean, what's going on here that, you know, and how can we get at that? Because it's an interesting statistic. I'm wondering what it's based on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, the analysis that led to that fiscal was based upon the problems with the 90-day supplies by mail order.
Okay.
So
do it by, so why don't you stop doing it by mail order to save all that money?
Mr. Chairman, the reason we do it is we're requested by people who purchase insurance to have that kind of a benefit.
Follow-up?
Yep.
I guess, and not to belabor this, but you know, what types of drugs, maybe certain drugs shouldn't be 90-day. You know, if you're taking something like, you know, anti-cholesterol med that you're probably not going to change, or some blood pressure med that you're taking, you know, you're going to take that day in and day out for 3 months, you're probably not going to change it. So I guess, you know, what are you doing to look, what is the industry doing to look at what's being prescribed, what the length of time is, can we find savings there? Because if we have 4%, that, you know, adds up after a while.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kotek, there are bills in this process that take away the authority of health plans to deal with prescription drugs that we've been opposing. The reason those bills have been introduced is that we do put limits on providers, and they don't.
Now,
like
let's
it.
Not go there because, you know, one of my bills. Well, you know, I'm not sure I agree. That I think.
Well,
that's
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kotek, you can't have it both ways. Either we do things to save money, or we don't, and.
Sure,
we do.
Yes, but yes, I would right. say the bill that I have, for example, that would require use of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program for our Medicaid plans, only if it's more cost-effective. If the folks who are providing the prescription drug plans for our managed care plans can say it's more cost-effective to do it that way because we're doing X, Y, and Z, great. If you can't show it, use OPDP. That's all that bill says. That seems harmless.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kotek, if it's competitively based, we don't object.
Mr. Chair, if I just may add real quickly, I can see that this is an interesting bill. In analyzing it, trying to figure out a way to help the good Representative Krieger, we also looked at, okay, why don't we have this apply to maintenance drugs? Because that's maintenance drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And the nuances of that are that depending on the situation, for a certain diagnosis, it is a maintenance drug. For another diagnosis, it's not. Therefore, a 90-day subscription doesn't make sense. The problem we run into is that we're going to have some prescriptions that ought not to be filled for 90 days. And I understand the nuances about the waste and so forth, but the more 90-day subscriptions you have out there, the more waste you're going to have, the more cost in the system. I don't know about the 2.5 million. All I know is that we had a 1.58% increase on the prescription side for this bill. But again, it's not, if you will, it's not written the way the sponsor would like it to be written.
What's wrong with the drafting of the bill? No, what's the problem? I mean, all it says.
The way it's drafted, we could require an individual to go to mail order, the way I read it.
I'm sorry?
We could require an individual to, or plan to go to mail order. I don't think it's drafted the way.
You mean you could allow a plan to satisfy this by going to mail order?
Yes.
I
agree with that,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's right. You have to order a 90-day.
See,
here's how we cover 90 days.
Exactly.
You shouldn't have said that because.
Well, that is. I mean, I think. I agree with you. I mean, I asked that question. I think.
I said that at the last hearing.
Yeah, I think it does allow that.
Fair to the sponsor.
And the fact is, I understand there are post offices everywhere. So, I mean, I imagine you could probably get a 90-day supply delivered by mail all the time. I mean, wherever you are. I have three medications I take that are all I get. I don't care however they send them. They do it by mail. They send it, give me 90 days, 60 days, 6 months. I don't care. Yes, sir.
Two things. One, addressing what you just said. We were out in Eastern Oregon on some hearings relative to rural pharmacy. I became aware, much to my surprise, there are ranches out there that only get mail delivery 3 or 4 days a week, and that they don't have access to post offices within reasonable driving distance. So, you know, what we have in urban areas may not be applicable to the rural. Secondly, another issue that comes to bear here, and it may be just a factor of the kind of infancy of these programs, is that I got caught up just recently with the OWEB system that my wife is on. Our long-term maintenance prescriptions, we were kind of gently pressured into going to mail order for those, because obviously it's a less expensive route to go under the current system, and those became 90-day. The short-term things, we are not encouraged to do that, but to go to our local pharmacy. A problem that poses in healthcare is it's exactly the wrong direction from where we've been trying to go nationally, getting people to go to just one pharmacy. And the reason for that, if you're going to two or three different doctors, they don't know what you're taking across all whatever. You could be doing a dozen different things. And so they'll prescribe something for you. A single pharmacy or a mail order pharmacy will run that prescription through their data bank, and it will pop up against all of your other prescriptions any contraindications. If you go to more than one pharmacy, you're going to be in a problem because they are only going to have a portion of what you're taking, so you don't get that benefit. And it really reduces the protection. You know, I know it's not a popular theme, but doctors do make mistakes.
That integrates that, right?
Yeah. But physicians do make mistakes in prescribing, and pharmacists catch a lot of them, as the system is supposed to be. But if you divide it up, it's more difficult. So, but we have great service of mail order that we're doing, for the portion that we're doing mail order. I don't think it's a service issue or anything like that. It's a shakeout of costs and convenience. It's quite frankly, it's more convenient to get 90 days.
Well, this also doesn't say about what to do copay. I mean, the way Kaiser got us to move to mail order, not us, because I don't have a copay, but those that did have copays, was by saying you get 3 months with one copay.
Same here.
If you go to mail order. I mean, that was the kind of stimulus that they used to begin with. All right, I'm going to do the same thing with this bill. I'll ask around. Is Mr. Powers disappeared already? Let us know whether you'd like to pass this bill. If you would, we'll put it back up on Wednesday or on Friday and pass it in this form. We're not going to be able to get an amendment now. If we pass it, they can straighten it out in the Senate. If there's not much indication that you'll want to pass it, we'll just let it go. Now, I want to carry this bill over, HB 2057. And I want to make sure, I'm sorry, 2925. I already carried over 2527. I'm going to go over the whole list again just to make sure they're carried over, because if we miss a carryover, the bill's dead.
We can't.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure that's true. In another committee...
We've been told it is.
Well, if you were told that was?
Yeah, if it's not posted already.
Never mind then.
That's my understanding.
But we'll just make sure we don't have that problem. So let me... is this the right list?
These are the ones that Laura has being carried over.
She already has those?
They're all carried over.
And let me try and do it the other way. Do it. Do you have a clean agenda?
Anything not moved.
You guys can. I'm sorry.
Say anything not moved is carried over.
Yeah, but I think we want to get explicit.
Nice try.
I'm carrying over HB 2009A.
Yeah.
So we're carrying over HB 2702. We're carrying over HB 2967. I hope we can get a fiscal on that one. I'm carrying over... not that one. I'm carrying over 3418. I'm carrying over 2057. I'm carrying over 2118. Boy, we've got this huge bow wave in front of us. And I'm carrying over 2925. And thank you for patience. Hang in till 6, just in case. Not today. And we're adjourned.